Hey guys, this is Mel Chang and I'm your host for the She Dares podcast. Every week I talk to different women who share their highs and lows in life and inspire us through their individual stories. This week I'm joined by Katina in Australia. I met her initially through my wife about 17 years ago. She's now working for the Little Linen Company as sales and marketing manager. And in this episode, we talk about her initially leaving Australia, her overall career, redundancy, and also the struggle of finding work during a pandemic. Okay, looks like she's just joined the call. Let's get going. Hey, Katina, how are you?
Hey, Mel. I'm good. It's been like an age since I've seen you in the flesh. I mean, I know that we've caught up on Skype, Zoom, WhatsApp.
I know. It seems forever, and I can't wait to come and see you over there. Unless you're going to come to Europe anytime soon.
Oh, well, with these borders and restrictions, I mean, we're in our sixth lockdown here in Melbourne.
I know, it's insane. I'm wondering whether it's going to kick off again this winter. We'll see.
Fingers crossed it doesn't.
So I wanted to get you on the show because I know you've had a very, very interesting life. And I just wondered, you know, was there any kind of like pivotal moment or turning point in your life that you wanted to talk about and share with the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, so many. But I think probably my biggest one was leaving the sunny shores of Australia and heading abroad. But I guess like anything in life, what I left for and what I ended up doing ended up being two completely different things.
Okay. When did you leave?
I left, I think it was in just after the Sydney Olympics back in 2000. And I had, up until that point, a really amazing life in Sydney and Canberra where I grew up. And then there was a tragedy in the family. So my uncle died at the age of 52. He was swept off some rocks while fishing and was knocked unconscious and drowned. Yeah. And I think that sort of got me thinking about sort of finding out who I was and where I was from. So where my mum and dad were from in Italy, because I'd never really ever embraced being Italian. You know, I just grew up in this kind of Australia that was a little bit racist. It wasn't kind of cool to be sort of overtly Italian, you know, growing up in the era that I did. Mm-hmm. Even though I did end up working for like Versace and Italian brands and all that kind of stuff. So I left, and the idea was I'd move to Italy and learn Italian. But I left with my dad, actually. So my dad hadn't been home in 34 years. And yeah, I got to the village. It was amazing. I'd only seen him cry a couple of times in his life. One, when his brother died, and then two, when he was reunited with this family. But as it happened, I sort of ended up sort of traveling around Italy and running out of money. And I went to Paris to see a friend of mine. And there I really ran out of money. So I thought, best I think about working. And I had a bunch of English friends because I used to live in a warehouse in Sydney where I lived with some English kids that had moved over to Sydney, and then some people, these crazy boys from Manchester, who once dared me to shave my head, which I did do. Anyway, I waved Jean-Paul goodbye at Gare du Nord with a return ticket saying, I'll be back in 3 months. I'm just going to go work in the UK, like in London for 3 months and make some money. Anyway, when I got there, I ended up scoring a job in wholesale, which I wanted to do, for an Australian brand that I adored called Mooks. And back then in early 2000, it was like uber cool. So I'd kind of like literally landed this dream job that sort of propelled me into this kind of career, sort of in street fashion and fashion, which was fantastic. I mean, I did lie at my interview, which but not about the job. It was about driving because I didn't have a license. And I think I, when I actually stood up to leave, Simon Holmes, who was the manager there at the time, said to me, you can drive, can't you? And I don't know where I pulled this white lie from. Not a white lie, it was quite a big lie, saying, of course I can. My license has just lapsed. And then it was kind of like, you now need to learn to drive. So I learned to drive with the British School of Motoring every Saturday morning for 2-3 hours with a lovely guy called Nigel, who I learned a lot from, actually, about linguistics and how to talk to people and how to use language. So got a lot out of that. And then I had, like, you know, I just went from job to job to job, worked for some amazing people. I mean, I did that thing that you do where you sort of think, oh, I can go and get a job in anything, really, and I can apply sort of my business know-how to it and not really sort of like the brand. Like when I went to work for Echo and G-Unit, I never really looked good in a tracksuit and I couldn't really bear the hip-hop. Used to go into the showroom every day and just play Kate Bush, actually. that was quite interesting. But I did end up sort of like then working. I had this sort of need to eventually one day go back to Australia, and I decided that I should start working with the international brands and working in the international markets, which is what I actually did. So, yeah, worked for some amazing people, met some amazing people, came back to Australia sort of on the back of a kind of, you need to go manage our business over there for a little while, when I worked for the Grow Company, so moving into baby or infant wear. And then it was just this kind of weird, all of a sudden I was back without really knowing I was back. I was back for a year and they sold the business and I decided to stay. And then like 2 years after that, they made me redundant.
You mentioned a redundancy. Were there any other redundancies or any lows in that period?
There were, actually. So I was made redundant in the UK. But the experience in the UK differed greatly to the experience in Australia. And the reason being that I was working for a French company in intimate apparel. So you'll be familiar with Wonderbra, Shock Absorber and Playtex. Iconic brands, and they were shutting the office or the export office in the UK and relocating it to Paris. And they said, if I'd like to go across to Paris, and I said no. They kept me on and I basically managed the redundancy, if you like. So I let them know when I wanted to go. You know, I got a retention bonus for staying past a certain date with them. So it was kind of like a nice feel good redundancy, if you can have such a thing. And when I left there, I with my partner at the time, came back to Australia or went to Australia for a bit of a travel around because he's British and had never been, so it was kind of nice. And then when I got back to the UK, like within I think 3 weeks, I had secured another role with another iconic company or brand, like one of the oldest hatters in the UK. And I stayed there for a while. And the chairman there, who I interviewed with, didn't stay very long, but we kept in contact. And he was very much, I'd like you to come and work on this brand in an international role. We'll create the role for you. But the actual field of work isn't going to be so much in fashion. It's moving across to baby and nursery. And that's when I became a part of the Grow Company, which was fantastic, actually. So he boasts that I'm the only person he's ever hired twice, which is kind of a nice thing to say. And he's actually one of the founding fathers of Innocent Smoothies. So it kind of comes with a bit of a yay, which is quite sweet as well. So, yeah. And then with that role, I came out to Australia and stayed here in Australia. And then came the big redundancy.
The big redundancy, yeah. You want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, because I think it's kind of, you know, I was in the UK for about 17 years in total. And then even moving to Australia with, say, Grow, because I was a director of that business. And when they sold the business, I thought, happy days, this is fantastic. But the redundancy came. And I remember it was still a little bit of a shock, but I was quite happy it had happened. But it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I don't think I realized what that actually meant. And I think because I was still kind of reeling from the fires, which is another kind of like segue into all of this, I guess. So in the December and the January of, say, that year, so the end of 2019 and the beginning of 2020, we had those devastating fires in Australia. And my family have a beautiful piece of land that's off-grid on the far south coast of New South Wales. And we were completely surrounded pretty much by fire. We were very lucky because the fire got within 2K of the house, but we were really, really fortunate that it didn't get us. But then there was a lot of panic and being in the area and having to sort of evacuate and then lose contact with absolutely everybody and not know if, you know, like my dad stayed behind to defend the house because he had to take gas tanks down into the dam so they wouldn't explode if the fire hit the house. It was quite scary. So I think the redundancy after that didn't seem like a lot. And I'd started then on this path of kind of, you know, wanting to give back a little more as well. So I was kind of relieved when I got the redundancy handed to me. But yeah, I had no idea what was coming next, I guess.
I mean, yeah. I guess something like that, a natural disaster or something, kind of puts things into perspective sometimes. And then potentially probably distracted you away from what was actually happening with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that the fires just kind of, I mean, I always loved being Australian and coming from Australia and Australia in general, but this just made that love grow even more. So in regards to kind of coming full circle with finding out, you know, everything about being Italian and then coming back to Australia and then just kind of being a part of that. I mean, it was just, yeah, it was quite confronting, but also made me realize where I really wanted to be. So in that respect, I'd come full circle with working out who I was and what I wanted to do. The redundancy, I think I kind of took it as, I was just bizarre because I don't think, like, I knew about the pandemic, but then I had this list of things that I wanted to do. So with the redundancy, I thought, right, I'm going to grab it as an opportunity to really do something or do all the things that I've wanted to do that I never got to do. So I, one of the first things I did was I started donating blood and plasma because there was a call for that kind of product, if you like, as a result of the fires, because I think, you know, a lot of people couldn't go out and donate. And here in Australia, you're not paid for your donation and you're heavily screened and you can only do it, I think, blood is every 3 months, plasma every two. And so I thought, I just felt like giving back. And then I tried to join a whole bunch of organisations to do volunteering, which was actually quite difficult because you had to commit like 22 weekends and I was never in the right place for that to happen. So I donated some money to WISE and the Red Cross and that kind of thing. I then also booked in for a breast reduction, and that's when I realized this pandemic, like, this shit is real. Because I remember saying to my surgeon, I've got fashion week next week and I want to go see the Sleaford Mods. Do you think I'll be all right to go? And he was like, oh, I don't know about that, love. Like, it is major surgery. And I thought, I'll be healed. I'll just hold my boobs. But there was no way. And literally at that last day of Fashion Week, that's when they shut the country down. I think that was the 10th or the 14th of March. Yeah, it was a terrible time. I mean, I still didn't kind of realise that it would go on for as long as it did. And I thought, oh, I'll be back at work come September. Anyway, when I was had all my scars healed and got the clearance from the dermal nurse and the surgeon, I thought I'd go for a wee holiday up north in New South Wales. So I packed the car for 4 weeks and I headed to Byron Bay where my brother lives via the house on the coast and all the rest of it. And when I was in Byron, they shut the borders. And then I thought, well, I'll just stay for a little bit. And then I was shut out of the state for about 22 weeks. So I didn't end up going back until towards the end of November and negotiating, sort of looking for a job in that time. Like, it's not that I started to get desperate, but I think you sort of start to get a little bit anxious about looking for work, especially when, you know, you're in your 40s. Yeah, it is really tough, I think. Mm-hmm. And you do tend to go up and down.
What was going through your mind at the time, knowing that you were stuck? Well, not stuck. You were there for 22 weeks and you were kind of looking for a job.
Oh, it was difficult. It was really difficult because I think that a lot of industries had kind of, there were jobs, But when I would apply, I was always told that because I'd not worked in that particular sector, that there was no way that I would be considered. And, you know, I used to kind of do the, oh, but, you know, I've got transferable skills. I've worked for all these amazing brands and done all of these, you know, achieved amazing things in my career, but it wasn't enough. So that was kind of the struggle that I did have. I think in total, I probably applied for over 300 jobs. You just needed to send your CV or through recruitment agents and stuff like that. Yeah, it was tough. And then the ones that I did interview for, I'd really, you know, put my heart and soul into writing the cover letters. There was one that I applied for earlier on, and it was I had to do this virtual interview, and I don't know if you've ever done one where it's just like a list of questions. So you're not being interviewed by an actual person. It's kind of like a full screen of just you. You read the question, you have one attempt to answer it within, say, 3 minutes, and then submit it with no re-record. And that was really difficult. And I remember I was at my mum and my dad's house, and, you know, mum and dad's house have had for years, it's a beautiful house, but every inch of wall space is covered. And so I found this space in the living room underneath a picture of The Last Supper, and I positioned my computer on a bunch of books. I'd sort of edited out the picture because I thought, you know, you can't, it just looks a bit strange, really, you know. And then halfway through this, like, answering questions, talking to yourself, really, they wanted a written portion of it, and I thought, oh good god, what am I going to do here? So I had to take my computer off of its plinth of books, type, submit, and put it back on these books to answer the next lot of questions on video. And I was so sort of like thrown by the whole thing that, like, the picture was in, there was all sorts of just craziness going on in the background. And yeah, suffice to say, I didn't get that one, but I don't know if it was because of the religious.
Because of The Last Supper, no.
Yeah, I suppose it's that thing of you think you're going to do, you've done all the prep, you've done all the work, and then it's just one little thing that just throws you. But it was a really trying time. Like, I remember actually, I try and sort of, so in regards to managing, say, my mental state, like I've got a routine, and it's not so much a routine because, you know, when I was 26, I'd suffered from a bout of depression, and I remember having to go and see a psychologist and then learn all the skills of how to deal with panic attacks and so forth. And again, applying sort of that sort of, okay, I need to understand it. I need to learn it. I need to know how to cope with it. I've been able to manage it, and it was just one of those things that happened at that point in my life. And I applied sort of almost the same science to how I was with not having a job with COVID. So, for example, when I was still here, and before surgery and post surgery, I remember the one thing that I definitely couldn't give up was the boxing that I do. So I go to a nice sort of like little gym down here called Nine Rounds, and it's really been a saving grace for me. You know, like, I think just kind of doing something every day for half hour, because it's only 2% of your day, and getting, you know, your heart rate up and not having to think about anything other than the next move or the next little circuit that you have to do really does help. For me anyway, sort of balance me out, if you like. So puts me, regardless of what time of day that I go, and then just trying to be grateful for all of the little things, you know, because in part, I suppose I am quite privileged to live in a country where you can get support from the government if things go terribly wrong for you, and that, you know, I have a good family and a good circle of friends. But that's not to say that I didn't sort of fall apart every now and again. Like, I do remember one day in Sydney on the streets just bawling my eyes out with my sister, and she was trying to say, but, you know, you're okay, it's going to happen for you. I'm like, what if it doesn't? What if I go back to McDonald's? First job, you know.
I used to work at KFC when I was 16. Been there. So where are you now?
Well, I now work for, I'm still in, say, baby and nursery, and I work for an amazing company here in Australia. And how I came to this, I think there were probably four or five jobs that I went for, and this is one of them, over that period where I thought, no, I'm a shoo-in for this, for sure. You know, it was just like a natural fit.
If there was one piece of advice you would give yourself back to your younger self, what would it be? Or to anyone else?
I would have to say it's believe in yourself, you know, mm-hmm. and accept that sometimes you are limited by things, but that doesn't make you a lesser person in any way. I think doubt myself less is probably one of the other things too. So it's definitely sort of believe in yourself and less doubt. Don't ever be scared to fail at something as well, mm-hmm. you know, because to succeed, you need to learn how to fail. That's part of being successful when it comes to work and anything that you kind of do.
Yeah.
You can't always sort of toe that sort of, you know, middle of the road. You've got to go be brave enough to kind of move either side of it.
My whole life has been through failures, actually, or things that have happened.
Yeah.
And then I've gone off the back of that. You know, nothing's kind of gone smoothly, like, or what I thought.
The other thing that I'm learning a lot to now is how to say no. So, like, I get, like, a lot of meeting requests and hold a lot of meetings. And now I've started this thing, you know, during lunch where I don't book a meeting. And if they do, if I'm asked to, I always say no because I want to go out for a walk and kind of just, you know, catch up with, say, my allocated friends for your one-on-one time masked up at 1.5 metres and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Really important to save the time for yourself, yeah. As you know, Katina, everyone gets to give me a dare at the end of the show, anyone that's being interviewed.
Oh, yes.
Have you thought of something?
Well, this is kind of funny because, like, when we spoke about dares, I was just mm-hmm. like, oh, you know, it for me, for you, or for me to say to you, climb a mountain, swim across a lake, like, you'd be like, yeah, no problems. I can do that with my eyes closed. Like, you do all the extreme stuff. So I had a list, actually, but I think the one that I'd like you to do is find a place where you can donate some blood or some plasma, give back a little bit. I'm not quite sure what your take on needles are, and
I mean, I definitely don't love them, but, you know, it's
who does?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's like, oh yay, injection. but that's something I could do, yeah, and I haven't done that for a very long time, so yeah, that's a great one. Thanks.
Oh, good. Yay!
Thank you so much for being on the show, and really, really appreciate your time and to share your story with the world.
Thank you so much, Mel.
I hope to see you very, very soon. Me and Sam are awaiting a visit, or we will come over as soon as we possibly can when the borders are open.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. And I'll think of some extreme things that I'll be up for doing with you guys as well.
So I'm just on my way to my appointment for the plasma donation. I'm a little bit apprehensive because I don't really know what's involved. The machines look pretty interesting. You know, with giving blood, it's a needle, and yeah, that's it. I don't really know, so maybe I should have looked it up beforehand, what's involved. But, you know, let's see. And I guess it says it's going to take like 1.5 hours. I'm wondering if I've eaten enough, if I'm going to pass out. I've just come back from holiday, and I had a little accident on holiday as well, so I'm not in the best physical shape. I don't know if that affects it at all, but let's see. Just walking up to the plasma centrum now. I never knew it even existed. Drove past it so many times.
So I just filled out a couple of forms at the plasma centrum, and they've just told me to come back because they actually need more than 2 hours, and I don't have more than 2 hours before they close. So yeah, I have to come back tomorrow.
Oh God. So just got back in the car. I went there, had to fill out loads more forms again. And there was a question on there that said, if I lived in the UK for more than 6 months between 1980 and 1996, then I should tick the box. And so I asked the receptionist and she said, yeah, you've got to speak to the doctor about that. So then I waited, I spoke to the doctor. The doctor was like, yeah, you can't donate because of basically mad cow disease. So I'm like, are you serious? I've driven 2 hours to come up and only now are you telling me that that's why I can't donate. So I'm really sorry, Katina. I really, really tried, but apparently there is no possible way that I can donate blood or plasma in Austria because I was born in 1980, which means I was a child of the mad cow disease era. And unfortunately to say, that is my first dare that has failed.
If you want to check out how the dare went down, there's a reel on Instagram for every single one of them. Follow us at _shedares and let me know if you decide to do any of them with me. I'd love to see what you get up to.